Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
The history of the term political correctness is really fascinating. I think it dates back to the 20s or at least the 30s. And in sort of socialist communist circles, it was a way of sort of making fun of being excessively politically doctrinaire. That's what it meant, the idea of being, and they would make fun of their people on their own side for being like, you know, Lenin says it, it's true. This is ridiculous. You know, like, so PC was originally a term coined by people on the left making fun of their own side. And it means excessively doctrinaire, but people forget this.
Hope everyone had a really Merry Christmas for those who celebrate. To everyone else, happy holidays. See what I did there? We're speaking about a topic which is related to the discussion of happy holidays versus Merry Christmas. We're speaking with Greg Lukianoff, the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, otherwise known as FIRE. He is the co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Greg's team at FIRE reached out because he's recently written an article called The Second Great Age of Political Correctness. It's about how PC culture in the 1980s and 1990s actually didn't decline and fall, contrary to the popular tale. Instead, it went underground, and he's arguing it's back. Now, everyone knows, especially longtime listeners, that Sagar and I have traditionally avoided culture war debates. But as we go further and further into the show, we're nearing year three here, got another 6 months to go. We're finding that we just cannot ignore this issue. So whether it's these speech debate controversies that bleed into campuses, online spaces, workplaces, just saying that we're not going to deal with it just isn't going to work editorially. So we hope we can continue to engage with these seriously and reflectively. Definitely hit us up if we did not hit a good point here. Quick little notes before we get into the episode. Number one, hope you all had a chance to check out our Books of the Year bookshop that we set up last week. If you are still looking for some place to spend your holiday / Christmas loot, that's a definitely great place to do it. Secondly, check out the Substack that is going out this Thursday. Always a good time. Really enjoying growing that Substack list. Finally, huge thank you, Lincoln Network, for supporting our work. Let's get into the episode. Greg Lukianoff, welcome to The Realignment.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we talk about your piece in Reason, which is about what you call the second great age of political correctness, I want to have a meta conversation about the terms we use when we're discussing speech in this country. Because political correctness, wokeism, a lot of these different words tend to polarize immediately.
Yeah.
So how do you suggest, considering this podcast is a decently balanced space, why using that term, can we still move forward and have a productive conversation? Obviously, we will. I'm more speaking to the audience members who are deciding whether or not to turn off in the first 30 seconds.
No, absolutely. And definitely, I thought about this in considering the name of the first great age of political correctness. But it's partially because that was what it was known as at the time. Like it was considered this sort of PC, people that some think it was kind of a moral panic, but real things happened. You know, professors were fired, speech codes were passed, and that was kind of the term that was used at the time, and it eventually became a derided joke, even among liberals, saying, PC is lame. I even point out the pretty lame Jeremy Piven movie that came out in, I think, 94 called PCU that was, I kind of mark that as like, it's officially past its due date when there's a mainstream movie making fun of it. And there's a lot of talk, particularly in the kind of circles where I suspect we both live, that terms like woke, you shouldn't use them, or terms like PC, you shouldn't use them. And the more I've looked at, you know, market research and things that actually talk to, you know, the non 95%, like the non upper 5%, what Michael Lynn calls the overclass, these are the terms they understand. So like political correctness makes sense, woke makes sense. And given that so much of the battle is with people on campus who believe that language is everything, you don't want to get into a semantic battle with academics, because then half an hour has passed and you haven't actually talked about the substantive issue because people are still choosing terms. So there's a kind of, my friend Thomas Chatterton Williams wrote a piece about giving up on the term woke. And my response is, even though I don't actually really use the term much myself, I think PC is more historically correct because it was kind of the agreed upon term at the time, that it's also kind of pointless, because what ends up happening is you end up having this semantic debate about what you should call it when everybody knows actually what you're talking about. And the extreme kind of like, I can't hear people using the right term to be the term that they approve of can, to be honest, can be extremely classist. It leaves most of the rest of the country out of the conversation because they're not keeping up with what's the appropriate thing to call it now.
Yeah. And what's so helpful about the way you explain this, I had a discussion with a center-left person in the racial justice space, is he used the line, well, what is critical race theory? What is wokeism? And the problem with getting into the semantic debate, and this is why people do it, is it makes things so hypothetical, but it isn't literal. And at a certain point, we should just be able to have conversations where, look, for good or for ill, when we say the term woke, a lot of people assume that means prevailing racial discourse, like you said, in the spaces that you and I live in. Therefore, you should either, to a certain degree, either own it or not. I think this is useful. Let's move forward. But there is one thing I want to hit here. What do you think is the difference between wokeism and political correctness? Because these are actually two different things.
Yeah.
In a way that sets it up badly. To give a quick example, the problem with the like critical race theory debate is that there's this interesting, it's not even a trick because it's actually true. Mm-hmm. What you often see is liberals say things like, well, there's this parent in Virginia who says that critical race theory is reading a difficult book about race. This is just political correctness of the right. So these actually are two different things. I'm curious how you think about that dichotomy here.
Well, the history of the term political correctness is really fascinating. I think it dates back to the 20s or at least the 30s. And in sort of socialist communist circles, it was a way of sort of making fun of being excessively politically doctrinaire. That's what it meant, the idea of being, and they would make fun of their people on their own side for being like, you know, if Lenin says it's true, this is ridiculous. You know, like, so PC was originally a term coined by people on the left making fun of their own side. And it means excessively doctrinaire, but people forget this. So my first introduction to political correctness, it really kind of started before I even hit college in 92, it was more when I was in high school, was just very benign things like changing stewardess to flight attendant, trying to be gender neutral about this kind of stuff. And I didn't know as much about the attempt to get speech codes passed on campus. And they were passed all over the country. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the article is that by the time we were able to get our research really as rigorous as we wanted it to be, by 2009, I believe, and 2007, there was between 79 and 74% of schools had ludicrously unconstitutional codes that would be unconstitutional under the First Amendment. And this is astounding because what I call the first great age of political correctness had its symbolic end at Stanford, my alma mater, just 2 years before I got there, by the way, where a speech code was defeated there. And that was one of five speech codes that had been knocked down nationally. And there was a belief, and this is in books, this is all over the place, that given they were so roundly and soundly defeated, and by the way, mocked by people on the left and the right off campus, there was a lot of disapproval from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal to, you know, right wing radio and the, you know, left wing comedians, you know, made fun of it. That people thought that they just went away, but they also took their eye off the ball and didn't see that, amazingly, even though they were found to be unconstitutional and made fun of, the administrators quietly replicated them over and over again, sometimes verbatim. Ones that had been shot down at University of Connecticut popped up verbatim at Drexel University in Philadelphia.
Couple of things I want to hit there. You were going to help me understand a couple of concepts better. Why does the Constitution have anything to say around speech rights on campus,
right?
Especially at private universities, specifically at private universities, because what's interesting here is, and we'll get into this, the reason why there's this whole big debate around Twitter censorship that never really goes anywhere is that to a certain degree, not a certain degree, a literal degree, it's a private platform. Therefore, the First Amendment doesn't apply. So why does the First Amendment apply directionally to Stanford, a private university?
Oh, and this is fascinating stuff. You know, if you're a con law nerd, I'm a First Amendment lawyer, so your audience knows that. So the First Amendment applies to public college campuses through the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. It's a little convoluted, and it's not the way it was originally supposed to get there, but that's a whole other story. And by the 50s, it was clear that there was an idea of academic freedom that applied to public universities that at least protected professors. And by the mid-70s, there are very strong decisions in favor of the free speech rights of students. Now, how does this relate to private campuses? Like three or four ways, actually. One is that in the state of California, when they found out that Stanford was going to pass a speech code, there was a state law passed that held to this day, still holds non-sectarian private colleges in California to First Amendment standards. And this is something that if the country wanted to pass this as all over, that they could very easily do that because you can attach a lot of conditions to federal spending that you couldn't attach otherwise, or you could make it part of their nonprofit exemption, for example. I've always been a little bit leery of doing that because I like the existence of private institutions, but at the same time, most colleges promise freedom of speech. Most private colleges promise freedom of speech and academic freedom in their policies. And our position has always been, if you're going to promise that and you're going to get the best and brightest to come to your school under those promises, you need contractually, you need to deliver on these things. Mm-hmm. And in some states, that's also the law. So in North Carolina, there's been some decisions that make it clear that you will be held to your promises. Same thing in New York State, same thing in Massachusetts. Sometimes they interpret it as being you'll be held more or less to those promises. And then the third way is that sometimes state constitutions come into place. And this applies both in California and in New Jersey, interestingly enough. There was a case from the 70s saying that some First Amendment standards applied to the open areas of Princeton's campus.
And what's interesting here, I like how you took it to the actual choice to do something or not.
Yeah.
The federal government is making and state governments are making. This brings in the obvious, to do some left-wing advocacy here, the obvious sure. point about states trying to pass laws around critical race theory, that you can or can't actually teach that. So and this is where all of this discourse gets, and this is why I wanted to separate wokeness from political correctness, because because that's actually an example to a certain degree. You could argue, well, you know, if an institution, so I get your, I like the way you put this around. If an institution says they have academic freedom, then speech codes are really screwed up. I agree with that. Yeah. But also academic freedom would also suggest that you can teach the wokest of the woke things long as people are attending. So how do people, and once again, I'm not saying you're on the right on these questions, but it seems to me so much of the confusion comes that people don't have strong mental models for these stacked up different issues that are intersecting or separate. Yeah. How do you suggest people process this?
Well, it is the culture war makes everything so much harder. And it's kind of funny that I now have to say, it's like, you know, I'm a Democrat.
I was being fair to you. I was making sure to say that.
You know, but I think it's crazy that I have to say this, you know, because like when I was coming up, and I, you know, worked at the ACLU when I was in law school, I took every, all free speech was considered a sort of a defining characteristic of being on the left, in the 80s and in the 90s, the only place that was much squishier was frankly on campus. And to be honest, when I was, you know, younger, I come from a more working class background, I kind of thought of the weird, you know, the people passing the speech codes on campus were kind of like our almost like dirty little secret, like kind of like, this is a terrible idea. This is very alienating. And it shows a kind of epistemic certainty, like essentially, like if you're in the position where you think you can start banning speech, that means you must be pretty clear on you believe you understand probably a great deal more than you do. So in a lot of ways, and I feel like a lot of people feel this way, I'm a standard, you know, liberal free speech advocate, you know, from the 90s. But now, because I work on campuses, you get a lot of like people just assuming and just sort of writing it off because they part of the way that we unfortunately argue on the left and have, you know, my whole life is that if you can label something as conservative, you're kind of absolved from having to listen to it. And that's one of the reasons why I'm excited to do your podcast, because I love it. Anytime people just even try to have dialogue across lines, you're already doing something that most people don't bother to do.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I'm going to get to the question of what are the, everyone always asks you this, but it's an important question. I guess, what are the stakes when we're talking about speech beyond just the whole, what happens on campus, like goes everywhere eventually, that's it's an important point, but it's some, I want to get to the deeper version of that.
Yeah.
But it seems to me, as I'm thinking of this first wave of political correctness debates, and then the second wave, it seems to me that the principal difference here is that unlike in the 80s, those debates were like literally and figuratively academic, where if we're looking at the debates and issues on campus today, you're actually seeing a situation where campuses are actually these places where the bigger, broader issues in American society are being fought out. This was true in the 60s, but it seems that this was missing from the 80s point. So to what degree do you think that dichotomy is true? So 60s, there's Vietnam, civil rights, 2000s, Black Lives Matter, Trump. And then the 80s and 90s, it seems like you said, Jeremy Piven, C-list movie stuff. Is that a correct characterization of that?
The political correctness, that led to speech codes and led to some really, outrageous situations that were covered in books like The Shadow University or Charlie Sykes's The Hollow Man at Dartmouth, which is one of the better ones written at the time. And of course, Jonathan Rauch's great Kindly Inquisitors, which came out in 93. They were serious and there were real legal battles. People lost their jobs in some cases for saying the wrong thing, but it was at a smaller scale. For sure. And it was less common. But it's amazing to go back to read some of these early books because they kind of saw this coming back and being much more serious kind of the next time around, at least the best advocates like Charlie and Alan Corge. And boy, did it. And the whole point of the article, more or less, is that there was this thing that happened on campus, and it looked like it had resolved largely because professors and students also started to see being too uptight, too politically correct, kind of as a joke. And the speech codes were defeated, or so we thought. Yay, job done. Here we go. But what I'm saying is, and I've worked on campuses in 2001. And again, I worked at the ACLU. I'd studied the history of freedom of speech going back to the Tudor dynasty. I was still shocked, even in 2001, how easy it was to get in trouble for what you said on a college campus. And I have to say this, and it might sound hyperbolic, but given everything I've seen over 20 years, I have never seen a year as bad for free speech and academic freedom as last year. 2020 was a very demoralizing year. And of course, this comes from a place where there were the debates going back in the 80s talking about lack of viewpoint diversity, a lack of very poor representation by conservatives, for example, on campus. And that was when it was 2-1. On campuses in the Northeast now, it's 15-1. According to one source, I want to triple check this one, but the NAS is saying that it's like 132-1, at one particular department. But nobody disagrees that the skew is very big. And the reason why this matters is, one, because in the 80s, people were saying this isn't a problem. And then actually, it got much worse in the late 90s, the lack of viewpoint diversity. But also, when you have, Harvard, I think, has about 3% conservatives. When you have already such low viewpoint diversity, it's amazing that you can still find, as Harvard did, more than a dozen professors to go after and try to get them fired or sanctioned or otherwise kicked out. And this included people like Ronald Sullivan. Ronald Sullivan, I think, was the first residential dean in Harvard history. He's a criminal defense lawyer. And he defended, very briefly, by the way, Harvey Weinstein. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm a lawyer, and one of my best friends is a public defender. And what Harvard should have done in those circumstances was say, hold up, guys, I know this person is a horrific, a horrific villain. But we're lawyers, and we actually think it's noble to be willing to defend even odious defendants. That's part of the job. That's part of putting your morality, putting your own judgment of somebody to one side and serving kind of a higher good. And Harvard never explained that to students. And this happens a lot. There are opportunities when students go after an individual professor, the university should take that as sort of a teaching moment about free inquiry, the value of dissent, how you can't ever get to people being right if you never allow them to be wrong at different points. But they don't in the past 10 years. And a lot of cases, the professors end up having their career ruined. 27 tenured professors fired since 2015. It's hard for me to emphasize enough how remarkable that is. Because when I started, tenure, if it was related to your research or pedagogy, and your classroom teaching, you were essentially unfireable for those things. You could get fired for not showing up to class or, assaulting somebody or breaking the law. But for anything related to those three things, never. And we've seen 27 of them since 2015. We're at about 500 examples of professors getting like sort of what you might call cancel campaigns against them to try to get them fired since 2015.
What's the proportion of ideology to Me Too when it comes to those firings?
When it comes to
And even if Me Too, there's due process, but I just want to delineate the difference there.
How many of them are related to Me Too? Do you mean?
Yes. So basically fired professors, when you're saying professors are fired, why are they fired? Are we talking about, you know, your typical, so for example, the Harvey Weinstein one, like that's ideology. That's like belief in actions. And then there's professor who's fired for Me Too reasons. Yeah. Are these in the same category in terms of those statistics?
I'm sure there are Me Too related ones. I mean, the Harvey Weinstein one is, I can definitely see that connection, but for the most part, it's saying something that students get angry about.
Okay. That's helpful.
However, then I want to be clear here, and this is something that, you know, for more left-leaning listeners, there's a lot in the article about threats coming from the right. There's a whole section on, you know, the laws against CRT, which are unconstitutional as applied to higher education. They're deeply problematic as applied to K-12. They might not necessarily be unconstitutional because states actually have a lot of power to decide what curriculum is in K-12. But I also wrote like a 5,000 word like analysis of all this stuff. But a sizable chunk, you should know this, of the professors who are getting fired are coming from conservative activists off campus who will see someone tweet something, get really mad and like call everybody, get them on Fox News. And then next thing you know, the professor is being relieved of a job. That was probably about a third of the cases that we talk about. And it's funny because the culture war makes people so stupid. I'll have people when I'm talking about some of these cases and, you know, obviously haven't read my stuff because I'm talking about right-wing censorship all the time as well. And I have an example that's your kind of typical sort of like stereotypical case of someone running and getting in trouble for offending left-wing sensibilities. And they'll bring up, it's like, well, there is no free speech crisis, but the real crisis is all the liberal professors getting fired. And sometimes they'll even like unwittingly cite my own, my own organization on a lot of this. And it's like, yes, it coming from both sides means it's worse, not better for professors these days.
You know, something you said earlier helped me come to a bit of a conclusion, which I think is useful, which is that when you were explaining, professors weren't explaining to students due process, that idea, and then the same thing of academic freedom. What if it's true, though, that students actually get what's getting articulated? They just disagree.
Yeah.
And I would also place a significant bet that a decent percentage of Harvard's faculty and administration also would probably disagree. So let me just frame it this way.
Yeah.
Is a lot of the problem here that people on your side of this debate are presuming a consensus that effectively hasn't been revalidated since the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. I really don't think students are taught a lot about academic freedom and freedom of speech. We were kind of shocked to find that only two schools have orientation specifically about freedom of inquiry. And they all have, you know, during orientation programs about bias related incidents and ways to report offensive speech. So a student coming in hasn't been taught a lot about this in K-12. Civics is not very, very well taught anymore. It isn't in most schools' orientations. So they are very aware of from the anti-bullying movement, for example, of like hurtful and hateful speech and how that's bad, that there really hasn't been a strong effort to talk to students about how this stuff is important. So like even though I think that I don't think you should assume that even Harvard students have heard these arguments before, because the universities are kind of they give in like much too quickly, and they don't turn things into teachable moments when they have the opportunity to. And when you poll, you know, students on their attitudes about speech, they still, you ask anybody, even in like Saudi Arabia, do you think free speech is good? Everyone says sure, but then when you kind of dig down into it, it gets murkier and murkier. And and one thing I really want listeners to understand, I always get this argument, you know, about, well, you know, who cares about free speech on campus? You know, I only care about hate speech, and hate speech should be banned. Hate speech is bad, and you know, I'm a First Amendment lawyer. I think even hate speech should be protected. But the kind of cases you see on campus look nothing like the stereotypes that people have of them. They're much more ridiculous. And so there's a big case currently going on at Yale, where a gay Native American student for a multicultural student get together wrote a jokey email to get people to go to the event. Now, that used to be my job at Stanford. Like, my job was to write funny emails to get people to go drink. Like, it was actually an elected position and to go hang out. And he wrote it. One word he used was "come to the trap house," which is slang for a place where you go to buy drugs. And this got turned into this huge thing through the bias-related incident program there. An administrator really went after this student that was talking about, like, how incredibly insensitive this is. We've prepared an apology for you that you need to make publicly. They really threw the book at this kid. And what's amazing to me is that it's a kind of another day in the office for me kind of case. I see tons of cases like this. But the good news, at least on that one, was at least there's been some awareness of this issue raised in the last year. So there was a reporter who actually covered an awful lot of this and got to talk to a student. And so it actually did get me more media traction than I'm used to. That gave me an opportunity to be like, and by the way, like, the Yale's rap sheet on this stuff is all over the place. And some of the stuff that people should know that universities are doing wrong is being utterly cowardly when they do study abroad programs, you know, or they have any involvement with the Chinese government. Immediately, like, if this is going to be offensive to the Chinese government, we can't do any of this stuff. We can't offend the Turkish government, all this kind of stuff. And the cases are much more interesting in a lot of ways, and much stranger than you might expect.
Yeah, it's interesting. A way of summing up the good faith problem that administrators and faculty are facing, and frankly, people who work at companies, is they're seeing this. So this is like an obvious reference to the difficulties the New York Times is like Gen X and baby boomer management has with Gen Z and younger millennial staffers. They're seeing a world where, and this is sort of funny to push back against our right-leaning listeners, a lot of people on the right in the sort of IDW crowds will talk about how everything's decentralizing and no one likes institutions and people want to be left alone, not be told what to do. And if you imbibe that, well, a university can maybe try telling students things. An employer can maybe try telling students about values, but like, it's not a given at all that anyone will actually listen. Yeah. So I guess my question is, how do you suggest institutions, which really do matter, how do they conceive of themselves? Because in every other aspect of their lives, top down doesn't feel to work anymore.
Yeah.
Therefore, I think that lack of that realization in other contexts is added to. So not, this isn't just in the like racial context, is just added to like a real lack of confidence to say, no, this is what academic freedom is.
Yeah.
This campus is not a democracy. This isn't up for debate. That feels very difficult to say if I'm playing a 42-year-old at a university.
And one thing that I do always find myself pushing back on is there's a lot of sort of categorizing what's going on campus or in institutions as being mostly along racial and sexual lines. But from the perspective, when you look at it more as economists, it seems the battle is oftentimes much more along class lines. So big state schools are able to do this just fine. They're able to explain a lot of these concepts. It seems to be that the kind of people who come from, for lack of a better word, sort of elite backgrounds, going to these very elite schools, homogeneity sometimes of the ideology sometimes doesn't even get sufficiently questioned. And that is one of the things that makes it sort of hotter and hotter. When it comes to institutions, I wrote a piece with my co-author of Coddling the American Mind, Jonathan Haidt. We wrote this afterward for Coddling, because believe it or not, a lot happened since 2018 on all the topics we talk about. So we tried to write this afterward, and next thing you know, it's 50 pages long, and we're like, okay, this is not going to work. So we just started releasing it in installments, and we've been releasing it on Persuasion. And I have a whole article telling corporations how to keep your institution, your corporation out of the culture war.
because there is a sense, and it sounds really nice if you don't reflect on what happens when everybody thinks this way, that people want to bring their whole selves to work movement. This idea that you bring your ideology to you when you go to work, and that definitely younger people want to work at institutions that reflect their values, something, by the way, that Ronald Engelhardt saw coming in the 1970s. And that also sounds nice. So they want their companies, their profit, their for-profit companies to have an ideological bent, to stand up for particular issues. And again, sounds nice. The problem is that I run an ideological nonprofit. My nonprofit is expressive. That's the whole point of it. So if someone suddenly raises their hand in my organization, go, by the way, I don't believe in free speech anymore. Well, I should strongly encourage them to find other employment. But if every corporation in the country, or if a sufficient number of them become not just widget making factories, not just car companies, not that they also have a political identity to them too, you end up in a situation where it shouldn't be the case that you can't make a living or find a job in your field because, you know, you're a slightly non-doctrinaire political thinker. And I'm afraid that a lot of what we're doing right now in the culture war is what we call the polarization spiral, that essentially the attractor theory. I'm just reading a book about this right now called The Way Out. But just these things that if you follow the nice sounding path of every company feeling like they have to have an ideology and people who are nonconforming to that can be eliminated by Twitter mobs, you're creating a situation where the right and the left will be pulled apart even further than they already are. And I feel like 2020 was just a scary, scary year.
So here's the problem, though, and this is where the subtext of my questions is basically, yep, to what degree do individuals and institutions have power over societal forces? So for example, when you're talking about these companies, well, yeah, what happens when American society is polarizing and companies discover,
yeah,
actually we make more money by, mm-hmm, leaning into that polarization. So, yeah, you know, I'm from Oregon, and obviously University of Oregon will come up at some point because U of O is not the greatest when it comes to a lot of the topics that you cover, but Nike, yep, does the Kaepernick ad. It ticks off half the country, but Nike performs better because, yeah, the reality is that we just don't have this mass market. Yeah. The mass market hasn't existed since the 70s. If even that, if you're really pushing it. So to what degree does it, and there is obviously, especially in Silicon Valley, the whole mission focused company idea. Mm-hmm. So the idea is Coinbase is saying, hey, like, we are focused, yeah, on work. We're not taking political stands, but even that is its own specific ideology. So the creation, right, of that ideology,
yeah,
leads to other companies saying, oh, we're even woker than, yeah, that too. So I guess I'm just, let me just restate the question then. To what degree do you think individuals,
yeah,
have to swim within these forces,
yeah,
and resist them in either direction? So like, this isn't a left or right thing. To what, yeah, degree does a company have the ability to say, this is what we think?
Yeah. So I think what Coinbase did, you know, they were willing to suffer the consequences for it. But, you know, they took a lot of flack for saying we don't take political positions. We're a company, and we want people from differing political viewpoints to be able to work together. And if you don't like that, you know, we'll give you a generous severance. And 60 people left over that. So it's not going to come without a cost, but I do think that you can do it. The problem is right now that doesn't sound as morally inspiring, particularly people who live in the kind of bubble that I was at Stanford, you know, and I still am largely to this day, that essentially it's just kind of taken for granted. Of course you want to have, morally coherent, congruous organizations. But I work at an organization where part of our ideology, part of what we believe in, is deep pluralism. So I remember getting called out once. It's like, yeah, but your executive director, I mean, you're a liberal and an atheist, but your executive director is a Republican and an evangelical Christian. And I'm like, yes, and I'm extremely proud of that. We learn a lot from having people from different ideological backgrounds working together. There are insights that you're simply not going to get without having actual diverse points of view on your staff. And I think for advertising companies in particular, trying to reach middle America, if they're going to stay entirely in the, you know, Ivy League bubble, they're going to be missing out on a lot of what's actually happening in the country. And I'm afraid that these institutions and this is one of the things that I do think distinguishes the political correctness from wokeness. Wokeness has, it's just more pervasive, and it has a much more zealous kind of feeling to it. It definitely PC. There was an idea that we could have enlightened censorship, but it was still kind of measured in the way of like, listen, we're just going to pass these codes. They're really directed at bigotry and racism. Now, of course, as First Amendment lawyers could tell you, that's not the way it worked out. But some of the very first people who were punished under these codes were black students for saying things that were considered offensive to white students. It never works out how you think it's going to. But there was a little bit more. It was a little more measured. Now it definitely does feel like we've gone from a deep kind of sense of moral sophistication that I felt like we had in the first decade, kind of as exemplified in our art. You know, like all of our heroes were Walter White and Don Draper, who were amazing because they're so horribly flawed. And then suddenly, sometime in the past 10 years, it seems to be much more binary. It's much more of a story of good versus evil. And to me, that's a step backwards.
It's kind of funny. Basically, if we think of cultural arguments, we should be moving towards comfort with the gray, comfort with ambiguity. And it seems like we were actually going there. You know, I think of the stereotype of the 1950s, but it seems, but yeah. I guess the pushback against, I agree with you, but the pushback against what we're basically saying is, yeah, sometimes things aren't gray.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. You know, like playing like a anti-Trump liberal here. Yeah. Like when children are getting separated in cages, there is no gray and institutions need to take stand. So I get where that's coming from, but something I want to talk about, cause you did it in a sophisticated way, is the discussion of viewpoint diversity on campus. And there was a Stanford story that really, really frustrated me, which is that the student association has on multiple occasions refused to fund the campus Republicans bringing Mike Pence to campus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a person who's particularly invested in Mike Pence coming to campus, but and I think most listeners aren't either. But if you take a step back and think about what's happening here, Stanford is one of the best schools in the country, for good or for ill people, whether they drop out or not, because it's a Stanford reference, obviously, really do pass through there and move on to leadership positions in basically every industry. Yeah. And it's insane to me that the student senators, if that's what they're called there, are being taught that the way you handle debate in a society, the way you handle this figure, I disagree with their political objectives, it's actually a devastating, really bad effect that they are being taught, oh yeah, you could just totally not fund it and there will be zero consequences, because there won't be consequences. There'll be a Daily Wire piece. There'll be some like annoying like baby boomer in their mentions on Twitter, if they're even on Twitter, but you'll still get a job at McKinsey. You'll still make it into Harvard Law School. So, but wait, but the quick thing here, then I'll throw it to you. What's going to happen though, is once this person is elected to Congress, they're going to realize, wait a second, if they even rose this, I can't just not fund things I don't like. There's this whole entire opposition that I have not been taught how to handle. It's actually like the purpose of student government is that it teaches leaders how to lead in these complicated situations. But I think that was just a good example of how the lack of viewpoint diversity is actually, to your coddling of the American mind idea, like actually, like, I'm trying to find a better word than like retarding, but like that's actually like the technical word. Like it's actually holding back people's ability to engage in the society out of campus. But I'm just curious how you think about this issue.
Yeah, no, it's one of these things where my organization's commitment to have people who actually vote for different people working in the same office has really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And, you know, like I had this awesome life in San Francisco. I had the coolest, you know, group of friends. We would go to Burning Man every year. I was a First Amendment lawyer. Like it was so much fun. I was a, you know, Buddhist studying atheist, which I took as totally normal. We would go to yoga class in the middle of the day when I could. And then I get to Philadelphia, we're an organization where there's a, you know, staunch Catholic, an avowed Marxist, a pretty doctrinaire liberal, and a evangelical Christian. And I would never have guessed in a million years that it was the evangelical Christian who was the most open-minded and curious about what everybody else thought, who really wanted to have arguments and discussions and see where people were coming from. And it was, and she was such a lovely person. I remember just being like, well, I'm a horrible person, because I just kind of assumed you'd be like, you know, I don't even want to say it anymore. Like just kind of, you know, the stereotypes that people have of right-wingers, and actually having that one-on-one interaction really, really changed my thinking about a lot of stuff. And meanwhile, my inclination is to, if your assumption is that most other people in the world, in history, are either evil or stupid, you should re-examine that. Honestly, I think this is one of the moral intuitions that makes me good friends with Jonathan Haidt, is because we do this both across the world, because I'm a first generation American. And a lot of times when I hear Americans bashing people from Kansas, and literally they chose Kansas. And this was an actual discussion I had with a friend in San Francisco, and he was very delighting on like how horrible these rednecks are and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, you got to understand, I still see this country a little bit with the eyes of someone who, you know, who has one foot in other cultures. That sounds to me, how about if I were to change the word to Croatia? How about if I were to change the world to like a country, like to a foreign country? Because that's what you start sounding like, that essentially these are people very different from you. You don't know them, but you hate them. So I think that we do have stereotypes of how much more divided we are on a lot of different issues. The effect of polarization is very strong, and that's the one that matters. That's how much we hate each other over differences. But Fiorina isn't wrong on the idea. If you actually look at American positions on things, we're not nearly as far apart as you would think. We are getting farther apart, though, both in terms of effect of polarization and in actual. But we need to have dialogues so we can break some of the stereotypes we have of how dumb the person on the other side is or how evil they are.
And something I'm curious about is, when it comes to diversity on campus, what exactly is there to be done? So, for example, in the student government example I gave, the way this is handled in public university is viewpoint neutrality when it comes to school funding. Like that's the Supreme Court. I think Wisconsin. I think it was like UW Wisconsin. Like that's a very, like, that is an example of, here is this law, operationally a law / ruling that says, okay, it doesn't matter if Senator Kozloff doesn't want to fund the campus Marxists. He has to give out funding on a neutral basis.
Right.
But that's obviously not happening in the Stanford context. But the solution there would be the administration should say, moving forward, funding has to be done on an ideologically neutral basis. That's very easy. What isn't easy with viewpoint neutrality is actual conservative representation on campus, because the way this conversation tends to end is a liberal will say the very obvious dunk, which is a funny one, which is, oh, so you want affirmative action for conservative professors? And then you're always like, no, like that'd be ridiculous. So where does that discussion go next if we're going to have a productive one?
Well, one thing that is kind of funny about that, about the sort of dismissive, oh, that's affirmative action for professors. One, it usually comes from people who believe in affirmative action. And two,
that's the correct point.
part of the idea behind affirmative action, and this is all throughout the case law, is that race can be a stand-in for ideological difference. That essentially the idea of having people from different racial backgrounds is that you get more viewpoints. So it's kind of like, it's unacceptable to say you're going directly after after additional viewpoints, just cutting out the middleman. That's somehow okay. So like the snickering at it is also, in my opinion, kind of a sign of how isolated we are, because like we make these sort of snide, and I do sometimes myself, kind of snide arguments about, you know, what the conservatives are saying, and then you realize that the argument is actually more interesting than you thought. When it comes to what we do for higher ed, I mean, I was on Jane Costin's podcast talking about University of Austin. And I'm not sure if they thought I was going to come in with like a full-throated, oh, it's definitely going to be great. I was like, no, we should be applauding every experiment at this point.
And are you involved with UAS?
I'm not. I'm not on the board. I'm just.
Sorry, there were so many people on the board that I had to.
Yeah.
I was actually like, wait, like I should have researched this, but yeah, okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm not. But I'm pulling for it. You know, like I want experiments to work. And this is where I always begin. If just on cost and bureaucratization alone, just on for those two reasons, we should be experimenting as much as possible with easier, better, more rigorous, more thoughtful ways to deliver higher education, you know, at a lower cost, but a higher quality. Because, I mean, you know, I have to admit, like the fact that the two most influential schools in the country, Harvard and Yale, have, sitting to one side in their endowments, $100 billion between the two of them, they're still nonprofits, is kind of weird. We should be experimenting like crazy. We should be figuring out ways to reduce overhead, the hyper-bureaucratization of these universities, because we're partially funding that, particularly by giving them tax breaks to a degree. I think that one of the points of the piece is that we should really be rethinking hard about how to do higher education and reform it in meaningful ways and to do more experimentation, because I do think that this big kind of sclerotic, gigantic monstrosity that we've created is not necessarily all that great at producing better scholars. Some of the research on like how much people's critical thinking skills improve during their time in college is abysmal. And I hope they'll be following that. And meanwhile, it perpetuates privilege. It perpetuates sort of like an overclass. I think there was Mark Lemley came out with an article, 45% of like the class at Harvard, of the white people at Harvard, were either legacies, children of employees, or therefore like their intramural sports type stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's messed up. Like I'm thinking of even more kind of radical solutions, like schools that have absolute, like basically like starting to say to universities, listen, you get this massive tax break. You are not allowed to admit anybody on the basis of being an employee. You're not allowed to admit anybody on the basis of being a legacy. I mean, I think we have to go a lot bolder this time around than we did in 1995 and think everything was going to be fine. It's gotten too sclerotic. It's gotten too expensive. It's gotten too too bubbled.
See, this is really interesting because from my perspective, we had the president of Johns Hopkins University on, Ron Daniels, a month or so back. We got into a bit of a debate around this, but I don't actually have that much beef with legacy admissions in the sense that at a philosophical level, well, if Harvard, and this is different than public universities, like there has to be a distinction here. Yeah. If private Harvard, and this is also separate than the endowment question, because that's where like tax, that's like, well, we're making an affirmative choice through our tax structure to enable them to do that. So the question is if they're not going to expand their size and just sit on the money, blah, 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 blah. So let's just focus on the legacy admissions thing. I think that's a cultural decision. Yeah. I think if Harvard wants to say, look, like we want to have an environment where if you work here and your kid at least is getting, let's say, some minimum standard, which I'm sure is almost certainly going up. I have no problem with that. I think the problem the quick thing to add, I think Harvard should be able to determine what its class looks like, but they should also expand. So the problem is that it's zero sum. The problem is that America's population is tripled, yet Harvard's population hasn't increased. Yet, you know the stat, right? There's like a million actually qualified students who could go to Harvard. So my beef is with the lack of expansion given the actual number, not the fact that they are deciding, well, you know what? We actually think our culture wants to be one where we bring in people who have a relationship with the university or faculty children. But I'm curious. Yeah, I'd love to hear your response.
Well, I think we would be talking about something very different if Harvard was admitting 500,000 people. You know, like I might reconsider, you know, whether or not legacy was that big of a deal if it was such a tiny drop in the pond at that point. And Harvard actually does have more people than you would think, partially because of their extension classes. I think it's something like 35,000. They have a lot more than I thought. That was something I learned doing the research for this one. But here's why I think that we really do have to care what happens at, and this is a little bit where my class contempt comes out, what the fancies do with themselves, what the fancy schools do, because they disproportionately produce our ruling class/overclass. It is almost like it bugs me. And I have to explain this all the time to people because I genuinely resent. And this is something I discovered about when I started at Stanford. I'd never heard of Andover or a Choate or
the boardings members, the good Northeastern boarding schools.
Disproportionately, people in my class had gone to these schools that I'd never heard of. It's like, oh, this is the conspiracy. You know, like this is the thing that like that they don't tell, you know, most people in the United States is how about these powerful, exclusive feeder schools. And they, you know, like whether it's Josh Hawley or Ted Cruz or any number of important politicians on the right and the left, and it's all of the Supreme Court justices have attended Harvard or Yale at one time or another, all of them. They're disproportionately influential, and if we want to have anything that looks like any meritocratic, any kind of sense of equality, any kind of democratic, non-oligarchical way of looking at stuff, it's not acceptable to have this narrow number of ruling class institutions that heavily favor people who are already in the overclass, who are already in the elite class. So I do think what happens at Harvard and Yale matters, in my opinion, more than it should,
but we still have to take it seriously, given how much they do tend to produce the people who are in charge. I would also like to get them out of that job to a large degree, and people starting having more people, you know, choosing to go to some of these other schools, I think could make for a much healthier democracy. But we really do put these schools on a pedestal, probably more than they deserve. They deserve.
And this is an interesting debate for me to think about, because like I went to University of Oregon, so a decent but not incredible state school, and most folks in the spaces I spend time in, DC think tank world, like did go to these like elite overclass schools. But the one thing I noticed, and this is also what I argued with President Daniels from Hopkins about, was I'm not sure. So I've read Michael Lind. We've had Michael Lind on the podcast. So I actually know very much what you're talking about. You're referring to like the overclass, the managerial elite, professional managerial class. There's all these words for it. It's basically for listeners, it's basically the point that you shouldn't just understand America's class system through like income. So you could be a small business owner in Georgia who runs a very successful, let's say, plumbing contracting service. You make $150K, but you are still lower when it comes to the overclass status than a professor who makes $75K. This is why Lind thought is so helpful, because it explains a lot of the educational polarization and why, you know, just money first isn't helpful. But so President Daniel was just talking about, like, look, I think Hopkins is successful. We eliminated legacy admissions in 2014. We admit a black student from Mississippi. Yes. Trip the fifth from Vanderbilt /Trip Vanderbilt the fifth can still, you know, come from Phillips Andover. And we also have a middle class kid from California. We are building this diverse slate. But the point I made was, wait a second, you've just described the Barack Obama's presidential coalition. So like my point is, I'm not particularly, so I guess the way I'll put it here is, at a superficial level, I feel as if changing who actually goes into the institutions could matter. But the whole point of, and this is why I really recommend the article, the whole point of the statistics you're giving about how ideologically uniform these institutions are, and actually this is a pretty good response to me claiming that universities can't shape their students. The reason why the overclass systems works is it takes the Andover kid, it takes the Mississippi Delta kid, and it takes the guy from Cerritos, and it makes them all McKinsey consultants. So I guess that's actually the genius of the system.
I like that. That's well
said. So I guess what would, okay, so this is good.
Yeah.
What is the next step then? I guess I'm not really critiquing you. I'm saying there's a step that's missing beyond just getting rid of legacy admissions, because I still think you have the high degree of polarization, even if, because once again, Johns Hopkins doing what they've done hasn't, and I know this is at the margins, it's one school, but it didn't change the underlying problem in our society, which is polarization along educational lines. So what's the next step beyond just the legacy admissions bit?
Well, I have five things that I think everybody should call their president and ask them to do, which is, you know, drop speech codes, defend students and professors early and often, adopt the Chicago statement, which is an academic freedom statement updated, which about 80 schools have adopted, poll your students about what the environment there is like, and talk about this stuff in orientation. I have an orientation program run by scholars explaining the profound counterintuitiveness of some aspects of the discovery of ignorance of liberal science, you know, as Jonathan Rauch calls it. But that's not enough. And that's one of the reasons why I like the experimentation that's going on at places also like Minerva University, which is trying a very interesting model out in San Francisco. That's also, it's like hybrid in the sense of some of it is global and some of it's actually brick and mortar. Khan Academy, I didn't really understand how ambitious Sal Khan was in terms of the kind of higher education offerings that he
can you explain Khan Academy real quick?
What's that? Oh, Khan Academy.
Yeah.
It's such a wonderful story. Sal Khan, you know, loving uncle, I think at this point, but also now loving parent, would do these little tutoring sessions for his nephews and nieces on math and all these things that he's super good at. And he did them so clearly and so well, he started putting them up on YouTube. They got really popular, and now it's a big company and they're really high quality material. And I love it because it means that the autodidact, you know, and there are real stories about this.
like a little girl in Afghanistan, doing Khan Academy, sneaking away to take the SAT in Pakistan, and then coming back and getting admitted, I think, to Harvard. She's now getting her PhD in something. Like, that's the kind of stuff that really can create social mobility from exciting new places. I think the experimentation is going to be really key. When it comes to like, how do we get greater viewpoint diversity in higher ed? I mean, it would be so difficult, I feel like, at this point, to actually try to do that. Because I look at like what happened in the New York Times. 2016, Trump gets elected. The New York Times does all this soul searching and says, oh my God, we're really out of touch. We didn't see this coming. So let's get James Bennett on. Let's get Barry Weiss to join. Like, let's try to look at the red states. Let's write articles about, you know, people who end up finding themselves attracted to the alt-right. And at every step, they got pushed back and they stopped doing articles like that. James Bennett got forced out. Barry Weiss, you know, decides to leave because, I mean, some of the stuff that was being leaked would just look like she was on like the set of Mean Girls for a big chunk of it. It felt very junior high school. So the headwinds to actually trying to bring greater political diversity in a place that hasn't really taught about the value of epistemic humility, the way that you have to look at the whole world differently when you come to higher education, that actually that person you think you really disagree with, you should be changing your mindset to be incredibly curious about why, because you have to always take seriously the possibility you might be wrong. Unfortunately, I think so many of these institutions are so epistemically certain and so morally certain. And that's one of the things that does distinguish this age, I think, even from just 10 years ago, is that there's this real sort of like certainty crisis that essentially like we're just much too sure of themselves. So I can't think of any easy solution yet, but I'm definitely, you know, listeners, shoot me an email. Let me know what you think, because I would love to make a more equitable system. I'd love to be able to have better class representation in a lot of the fancies, and I'd love to have better viewpoint diversity among the professorate. But how you actually get there is going to be an ongoing question. And first of all, the first step is you got to get universities to want to make some of these meaningful reforms. And I think a lot of them don't really want to.
Yeah. And just to close to some of what you're saying, because obviously University of Austin made a variety of very clear marketing and definitional mistakes. I think there should have been much more show, not tell, when it came to the announcement. But it's too easy just to dunk on that part. And people should focus on the fact that the response to me is, okay, if it's changed the structure, it's like, okay, Marshall, if your critique is that the higher ed system is inevitably producing McKinsey overlords, then let's change the structure. That's my takeaway from what you are describing here. Like, that's why experimenting. So critiquing the tactics of UAS is different than saying, well, if you don't like the status quo, which no one likes, then we need to agree that experimentation will produce almost certainly if the problems are as big as they are. That's a really useful point. Greg, this is really great. You've got a hard stop, so I'll let you go. But anything you want to shout out beyond just the reason piece before you go?
Real pleasure, first of all. And, you know, check us out at thefire.org. If you know professors or students who get in trouble for what they say on campus, contact us. We can help.
Thank you so much for joining.
That was really fun.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.